Coming up on Tech Nation, neuroscientist Lisa Feldman Barrett follows up her book on how emotions are made with 7.5 lessons about the brain. She has some surprises. For instance, there's no reptilian part of your brain. That was just a myth. Then in biotech, treatments to fight diseases caused by inflammation, the focus of a new company, 180 Life Sciences. I'll speak with Dr. Jim Woody, its CEO, about their pipeline of drugs, as well as their lead compound in clinical trials. It's for Dupuytren's contracture, affecting 1 out of 25 people in Europe and North America. All this and more coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2012, Dr. Eric Topol, the founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, had recently written his first popular book, The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create Better Healthcare. He told me we were transitioning from what you call population medicine to individualized medicine.
Medicine today is everything about population, you know, mass screening and the same drug for all people with the same condition. It's all completely archaic now because we have the tools to zoom in on each individual and understand that person, the essence, to be able to deliver and render a whole different health care.
So when our doctor used to say to us, well, this is really good for that, they were saying, well, if we look at a whole bunch of people in a population, it tends to work. We're hoping it works for you. We're thinking it will.
You know, and the chances were low, Maura. That is, you know, maybe 1 in 100 that this pill could actually work for you based on some clinical trial of 20,000 people. That's not the way we want to practice medicine. We've got the tools to really change that now.
And that individualized medicine, is that the same as personalized medicine, or are you thinking in different sense?
Totally different. I think of personalized as a terrible term. It could be a concierge medicine. Individualized is really getting to the biologic individuality, the science of individuality at the physiology level, you know, at every level. So there are no two identical people in the world. Even identical twins have different epigenomic signatures. So this is a really amazing, opportune time, a kairos in medicine, because we now understand that and we can build on that to have remarkable prevention and better therapies going forward.
Well, what you said there in terms of the epigenome, if you will, the epigenetics, that's really important. We kind of all got the idea, hey, we have DNA, that's our programming. Hey, there's more in our bodies, if you will, to tell the picture of who we are. So let's talk about those omes, the epigenome and all of that.
Yeah, there was a lot of different omics. And so everybody's, of course, focused on the DNA sequence, genomics. But, of course, there's the proteins, proteomics. There's the metabolites, metabolomics. And epigenomics is, of course, the markings on the side chains of the DNA and how the DNA is packaged. And our exposome, which is our environment, another big om. So there's so many of these omics and omes. But each individual has that whole set of that mosaic that defines the person that we can now study, learn about, so that we can tailor everything to the person in terms of, you know, even as a fetus. Before birth, we can sequence the maternal DNA of the baby, no less at any point during life. But it's not just that, Maura. It's also the sensors. And I even brought a few of these to show you because they're pretty cool.
Oh, and that's not just a bunch of phones and things.
No. So, you know, like, for example, I've got one of these sensors for my minute-to-minute glucose I'm wearing.
And here, this looks like a sort of a thumb-sized white plastic thing.
Yeah, you just pop it on. You can wear it for a couple of weeks. So this phone here, I'll just turn it on. And, you know,
and you've got one of these stuck to your body already?
Yeah. So, you know, here is a time, and I'll just turn the phone on, and this is my glucose right at this moment, 113.
Wow.
And every minute it's updated, and of course what I can do is I can see my trend, you know, from minute to minute. Here's a 3-hour, and there's a 6-hour, 12 hours. And this is changes you because...
Well, wait a minute. Yeah. Where's the pricking of the finger every so often?
You do that
putting
like
that little monitor.
Once in a week just to calibrate it, and then you're good to go. But then you're looking at this cookie and you say, do I want to eat this cookie and watch my glucose climb because I'm going to be using my phone and I don't want to...
Biofeedback, instant.
Exactly. This amazing feedback loop.
You've been listening to a 2012 TechNation interview with Dr. Eric Topol, the founder and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and a professor of molecular medicine. Since that time, he's gone on to write two more books, The Patient Will See You Now and Deep Medicine, How Artificial Intelligence Can Make Healthcare Human Again. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is TechNation. Today on TechNation, I speak with Northeastern University neuroscientist and psychologist, Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's here today with 7.5 lessons about the brain. Then it's Dr. Jim Woody, the CEO of 180 Life Sciences, a new company, instantly global, fighting a host of inflammatory diseases, including Dupuytren's contracture.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now it's 7.5 lessons about the brain with neuroscientist Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Well, Lisa, welcome to TechNation.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I noticed two things right away about your book, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. First, I fully expected, as a child of the middle class who was taught to embrace delayed gratification, that I didn't have to wade through the entire book to get to the half lesson. You give it right away, and I want to thank you very much for that. And the second is, was that you relating a scientific nugget or two? Is that what you were doing with that half lesson?
The half lesson was really meant to set the stage for the rest of the book. Frankly, I find it really fascinating. Why do we have brains in the first place? I mean, many creatures, of course, they're tiny little single cell creatures, don't have brains and do, you know, pretty well in this world. So why did we evolve brains in the first place? I just found that to be a really, really interesting question. And originally, that was all part of the first lesson. So lesson one and the half lesson really were one whole lesson. And after I drafted the essay, I was working with my editor and we thought it was too long. And so I was like, I don't want to have 8 lessons. And they're not really telling the whole story of brain evolution. So it's kind of like a half a lesson. And then I thought, well, that's kind of a cute title for a book. So that's how we came to the half lesson.
Well, it's interesting to me because the first thing it does set up is that this is not just a book about the brain. It's about the brain and human nature. It's about the brain and who we are, but you still have to start with the brain.
I'm very fascinated by bridging the boundary between the sciences and the humanities. I love reading books that way, that do that, and I thought it would be very fun to write one. I also feel that science and philosophy are tools for living, not in a self-helpy kind of way, but in a real instrumental way. And they help guide you. They guide your behavior. They guide your understanding of how other people act. And so I thought it would be really interesting to try to approach some big questions that we as a society face and that individuals face in their everyday lives by interrogating what kind of a brain do we really have? how does that brain in conversation with our bodies and the rest of the world, which include other brains and bodies, you know, how does our brain create our mind? And what does that tell us about human nature? What does it tell us about who we are? And what does it tell us about our aspirations about who we want to be?
Well, if there's one thing we've all been told about the brain, is that we have reptilian brain or survival brain. We have an emotional brain and a rational brain. And you write, you have one brain. You have one brain.
Yeah, that's a myth. It's probably the one of the most successful scientific myths, I think, that scientists have ever created, frankly. And that's because it didn't start off as science. It started off as a morality tale in ancient Greece. And really what scientists did in the mid-20th century is they just took some pretty potent ideas about morality from Plato and just kind of tattooed it onto the brain. And, you know, if you look at a lizard brain with your naked eye and you look at a mammalian, well, there is no mammalian brain, but I mean, you look at a rat brain and you look at a primate brain or a human brain, they look kind of different to the naked eye. And so, you know, descriptively, with the techniques that were available in the early 20th century, mid-20th century, it was reasonable for scientists to come up with that hypothesis. But I would say as early as the mid-1970s, scientists had discovered that the idea of a layered brain, you know, with an inner lizard housing your instincts and a limbic system housing your emotions and the cerebral cortex housing your rationality, that I think we've known really for almost 50 years that that's just a myth. It's just a myth.
Now, let's get back to something earlier you said, and that's like, okay, well, plenty of creatures got along without brains. At what point in the evolution of creatures, we'll say, or organisms, do you have a brain? Do you say, okay, now that's a brain?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So when does a clump of cells count as a brain? And of course, you know, scientists often debate, the more important the question is, it seems like the longer the debate goes on, right? But I think the idea is so even something like an amphioxus, which is the little creature that I write about in the half lesson, which scientists pretty much agree more or less, there's a little bit of debate, but more or less agree that the amphioxus, the living amphioxus, which is also called the lancelet, the living amphioxus is a good model for the invertebrate animal that was the chordate, the animal before the split between vertebrates and invertebrates. So basically before the vertebrate innovations, all the innovations that came with having a backbone, which include, remarkably to me, a head, eyes, you
good
know,
to have.
Like all of these senses. So sometimes when scientists write about amphioxus, they will refer to the amphioxus as having a brain, but it doesn't really have the markings of a brain in the sense, they're using that term sort of metaphorically, I think, because the cells, there aren't enough of them, they aren't networked in a way that they don't have enough interneurons, which means neurons between sensory and motor neurons, and they appear to be continuous with the structure of the rest of the spinal cord. So it's, you know, there is a little clump of cells there, and if you sort of squint and take your glasses off, you know, you can say, well, I can imagine how some of those cells will become a brain in a future animal. The genetic markers in the neurons that are at the top of the notochord in an amphioxus, which is similar to a spinal cord that, you know, that we have, but at the top of the top of where the notochord is, have some genetic markers that are similar to our midbrain and what's called our hindbrain, which just means the brain stem, the subcortical parts of our brain. But it's not really functioning.
On its way there to being a brain.
Yeah, it's on its way. Yeah. And actually, what's interesting about it is that one of the aspects of Darwinian evolution that people don't seem to, or that they have a harder time understanding, is that evolution is gradual. And it might be slow, it might be fast, but it's always gradual. You always have these kind of intermediate creatures from one structure to another. And that's what you see, I think, in an amphioxus.
Now, we'll just kind of crawl along with the brain here for a while, in the sense that I have always heard in my life that there's a food chain. Like, first there's the little guy, and then a bigger guy wants to eat him, and then a bigger guy wants to eat him, and there's this whole food chain. And that requires hunting. And you said, we didn't start out with hunting.
Yeah, so this is amazing to me, actually. But if you go well back before the Cambrian period, you know, 550 million plus years, animals ate each other, but not with intent. So again, you know, think about the amphioxus.
Tell that to the eaten.
Yeah, exactly right. But amphioxus, you know, you can see little videos on YouTube of an amphioxus. So it kind of wriggles in the water, and then it plants itself in the sand like a blade of grass, and it just filters food that goes by. And then when it's detecting a decrease in the food, it basically ejects itself, wriggles to some random spot because it can't see or hear or anything. It just wriggles to some random spot and plants itself again on the likelihood that, you know, anywhere that it's going will have more food than where it's been. And that's kind of how it gets around. And scientists now speculate that the main or that an important selection pressure that influenced the development of brain was that creatures somehow figured out how to, or evolution somehow provided creatures with the capacity to hunt one another. And that this is probably a vertebrate innovation, which may have also been developed as a kind of convergent evolution in invertebrates as well. But remember, an amphioxus can't see and it can't hear. It doesn't have a head. It has no sophisticated senses, and it has some senses it doesn't even have at all. So it doesn't have what you would call distance senses. That is the ability to detect something up at a distance and wonder, like, is that thing going to eat me or should I eat it? And so it's with distance sense that you get predation. And predation hunting is thought to have driven a lot of really important things that our brains can do. Like, for example, when you and I talk to each other, we are automatically making inferences about what the other person is thinking and what they're feeling and what they might say next. And scientists call this theory of mind. And hypothesis is that theory of mind, what allows us to be social creatures, actually had its start in hunting.
What we still have in common with all of these creatures is that in every moment, our hormones, our organs, our immune system are producing a storm of sense data, and we are barely aware of it.
Absolutely. So, you know, right now, for example, as people are listening to this podcast, they are probably unaware of the fact that each one of them has a whole drama going on inside their own bodies. And frankly, it's really good that we're not aware of that drama, because if we were, we would never pay attention to anything outside our own skin ever again. There's a lot going on in there. And if that doesn't seem like common sense to you, just remember the last time that you had a stomach ache or cramps or, you know, something inside your body didn't make you feel very well. You know, when you have something that you can actually sense inside your body, it's really hard to pay attention to anything outside.
It overrides everything else that's going on. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. And so, there are some things that we are not wired to feel at all, except under the most extreme circumstances. So think about, you know, if anyone's ever had appendicitis. When you have appendicitis, your appendix is about to burst. At the beginning, you can't feel anything but a dull ache in your whole abdomen. It's like not even localized. And as the appendicitis gets worse and worse, you're still, it's, you know, not, it's right up until the point right before when it bursts, when it will kill you. that you feel a very specific pain, a very specific jab, you know, in that location in your body. But most of the time up until that, you're just, what you're feeling is kind of like, you know, ache, dull ache, which is getting more and more and more intense. And I don't know if any of your listeners are women who've been pregnant, but I will tell you that the first time that I was kicked in the liver or pancreas or whatever the hell it was, that was a sensation that I just had never, ever had. And like, ever.
And it's a singular kick. You see, it's very precise. It's not like someone hit you on the outside and hit a bunch of organs.
No, but and
it's right in
it
there.
Is. And also, right at there. First, you know, you have experiential blindness for it because you're like, what was that? What was that? But, you know, because it's just we're not really all that in tune with the insides of our bodies. And that's a really good thing, actually, because it would draw all our attention. And in fact, in some illnesses, for example, you know, one way to think about depression, for example, is that people's brain, you know, that a person's brain is kind of to some extent hijacked by its body. The person's body is just has a clamp down on the brain, and the brain can't really attend to what's going on in the world too much because there's too much discomfort, you know, inside the body. Also, chronic pain is a very, very similar. Well, chronic pain is really a problem in your brain, but it's your brain believing there's something wrong with your body and modeling sensations that it believes that are going on in your body, and it just can't dislodge itself from that.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Lisa Feldman Barrett, a neuroscientist and psychologist. Dr. Barrett is a university distinguished professor at Northeastern University with appointments at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. You may remember her from her earlier book, How Emotions Are Made. She's here today with 7.5 lessons about the brain. Well, we won't talk about each of the 7 lessons, but here's one I really liked. Little brains wire themselves to their world.
Yeah, so an infant brain is not a miniature adult brain. It's a brain that is waiting for a set of wiring instructions from the world and from the infant's own body. And what this means is that the brain is born unfinished in a fairly substantial way. You know, so a lot of creatures, when they're born, they're born and then, you know, like think of a little horse, you know, it's born and then the colt is like up and around and, you know, within like the hour. Infants, you know, what does it take? Like 9 months for an infant to learn to walk? I mean, they can't even burp by themselves when they're born. And they're really, really helpless little creatures. And that's because their brains are so unfinished. And so there's a lot of input, visual input, auditory input, you know, all kinds of sense data from the world and from the infant's own body that are necessary for finishing that brain. But I think the really remarkable thing is that there's also social input that's required to finish a brain. So things like making eye contact with a baby, speaking to a baby, holding a baby, feeding a baby. These are all things that actually are what scientists call expectable input, meaning the baby's brain is expecting regularities from the world to finish wiring. And if it doesn't get those regularities, then very, very bad things happen.
Well, it's one thing if a baby is born full term in our vernacular, if you will. But what happens if a baby is born, say, 2 months early and is in the neonatal intensive care unit?
Well, I would say a couple of things are important to know. First of all, neonatal care is made huge advances in the last couple of decades in providing premature infants with what they need to develop properly. So, for example, in some units, they will provide the infant with sounds of the mother's voice muffled as if they were still in utero, for example. And that actually has an effect on the development of the auditory cortex in that infant. But more generally, what I would say is all of an infant's neurons are born, essentially, are birthed off the neural tube before the infant is an infant and when it's just an embryo, right? So all neurons are born in an embryo, and then they migrate to where the position where they need to be, and then they grow, and their axons grow, their dendrites grow, like all the little little connections grow. And so an infant that's born prematurely, like say in the last trimester, still has, it's not a brain that's equivalent to a newborn brain of an infant that's born to term, that, you know, was born at term, but it's still got all its parts. It just needs a little more time to grow. And so, some of the input that it needs will have to come from outside in the world instead of, you know, inside in the uterus. This, of course, begs a really touchy question, which I didn't describe in the book, which is a fetus before it's born learning? Like, is the fetus receiving sense data, and is it learning? And I think that there's really no question that at least in the third trimester, there's no question that the answer is yes. That fetus is taking in some sense data from its surroundings. How much sense data is not clear, and just how important it is not clear. But newborn infants are born, for example, recognizing they cry with an accent that is similar to the verbal language and sounds of its caregiver, the woman who birthed it. So clearly it's learning something.
Now let's get back to how our brains work, in the sense that we've already established we have all of these sensory inputs. And for the first time ever, I got a perspective that I thought there was just a lot of information in my brain, but you're like, no, you start out with a whole lot of little information that cascades up or gets summarized up until you get up to a much a big knitting of all this information together. Now I'm paraphrasing you. Describe for people what goes on in your brain, how you get these sort of little inputs and it goes all the way up to a lot of very dense information.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to realize that brains don't react to things in the world. Brains predict. Your brain is using your past experience to predict what's going to happen next.
Neuroscientist Lisa Feldman Barrett is the author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation are available on NPR One, Spotify, and Alexa Podcasts, among others. Direct links are available at technation.com. In the second half of our show, Dr. Jim Woody, the CEO of 180 Life Sciences, will talk about Dupuytren's contracture and other medical conditions all related to inflammation. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Northeastern University professor Lisa Feldman Barrett, the author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain.
The way to think about it really is that your brain is trapped in a dark, silent box called your skull. And it's receiving sense data from the world through your eyes and ears and nose and so on. And any given flash of light, any given change in sound can have many, many, many different causes. But you don't have access to the causes. You have only access to the outcome. So you hear a bang. Well, what is that bang? Is that somebody drop something on the floor? Did somebody slam a door? Did somebody slam a car into another car? If you're in the US, you know, did a gunshot go off? Like, what was that bang? And you don't know. What you know is that you heard a noise, but you don't know the cause of that noise. And similarly, when you when your body is always sending sense data to your brain, you're unaware of it, but that's what's happening. And so when you feel a tightness in your chest, is that anxiety? Is that hunger? Are you having trouble breathing? Are you at the beginning of a cardiac event? Like, what's the cause? All your brain is getting is the effect, but it doesn't know the cause. And when you have to go from effects or outcomes to causes, that's called a reverse inference problem or an inverse inference problem. And so that's what your brain is attempting to solve every moment of your entire life. And the fact is, if you had no prior knowledge of anything, you'd be just in a big sea of ambiguity and uncertainty because you wouldn't know what the causes are of the sense data that you're receiving. And when I'm talking to people live, I have some examples that I use where I basically show them something that they have no experience with at all. And so they are what's called experientially blind. And then I give them an experience and then their brains can draw on that experience. And all of a sudden, poof, they see something, you know, in a black and white blobby image that they've never seen before. And frankly, now for the rest of their lives, every time they look at that blobby image, they're going to see an object in it that actually isn't there. It's partially, you know, everything that you see, everything you hear, everything you taste, everything you feel is some combination of what's in your head and what's outside in the world and what's coming from your body. And so your brain is always guessing, and it's guessing using your past experience to make sense of the sense data that's coming in through your eyes and your ears and so on. But the interesting thing over and above that is that it's all happening at a timescale that's completely, you know, unexpected by us and sort of violates our own intuitions. Because if we were to stop everything right now, just stop time, what would happen is that your brain has a model of what's going on in the world and what's going on in your body. And it's guessing what's going to happen next. It's guessing what you're going to see next, what you're going to hear next, what you're going to feel next, and what you're going to do next. And those guesses are not some kind of abstract thing. Your brain is actually preparing itself. It's changing the firing of its own neurons to prepare to hear and see and smell and feel and do certain things.
You talk about social reality. Let's go there.
Sure. So reality, physical reality, you know, is what it is. I mean, you know, things are solid, you can place something on them. You know, things are liquid, you can drink them, and so on and so forth. Social reality occurs when a group of humans, and I'm specifically saying humans, because as far as we know, humans are the only animals who can really do this, that a group of humans take something that by virtue of its physical nature alone does not have a certain function. But we all agree that it will serve that function, and so then it does. Okay, so the perfect example of this is money. If we all agree that little pieces of paper can be traded for material goods like food, then all of a sudden those little pieces of paper have value. And they don't have value for any reason other than we all imposed value on those little pieces of paper. Similarly, this one's my favorite, right? Like air rights. So in New York City, and maybe in all major cities, the air above a building is actually, you can sell it so that other people can build there. Or think about fishing rights in the ocean or something. Though these things have value only because we agree that they do. Mortgages are just a promise of money in the future, but those have value too. And they were bought and sold and had value until someone decided they didn't. That is, they withdrew their consent, and then they stopped having value. And so many things in our everyday lives, which we think of as real and which have real impacts, are actually socially real, meaning that a group of humans decided to impose a function on something that the thing didn't have by virtue of its physical nature. But because humans, you know, had what's called collective intentionality, they all agreed that that thing has a function. It does. Just by virtue of agreement. And if people stopped agreeing, it would lose its function. When I say humans have to agree, I don't mean you have to consciously agree. You just have to, your behavior has to be in line with other people's behavior. So when I'm married, and I don't walk around saying to people, I'm married. I just wear a ring on a particular finger, and everyone knows that that has a particular meaning. Right. And it's agreed upon meaning, unless you're in Europe when you should be wearing a ring on your other finger, on your other hand. But, you know, in North America, it's on your left hand. Right. And a lot of things that are really precious to us are social reality. Like, you know, you draw a line in the sand and it becomes the border between two countries. And all of a sudden you've conjured immigrants and citizens. And that has a very real effect, physically real effect on people. A president, a prime minister, a queen, but let me say it again, a president, that is social reality. A president has powers just because we all agree that he does. And I say he very specifically because in the United States, we've never had a female president. He has those powers because of the things that we do and because of the things that we don't do. So democracy is social reality. And most of the time, physical reality constrains social reality. Like you and I could agree that we could walk through a wall, but that won't make it real. You know, we could all agree that we could eat glass as food, but that's not going to make it real. There are physical constraints. We could all agree that a virus isn't really a virus and dangerous. But like I said before, physical reality always wins when the two come up against each other, you know?
Now, besides the half lesson up front and the seven essays, you have an appendix here. And before you make notes on every lesson on each page. It's very interesting. But before that, there's just a page and a half. And you talk about something very near and dear to my heart. And you have a graph even. Talk about the challenge of writing about science for the public. Let's go there.
Sure. So, you know, as a scientist, when I'm writing for other scientists, the goal is to be as complete as possible. So the information has to be accurate, but it also has to be as complete as possible. That is, every little tiny method that I use in the laboratory or out in the world has to be documented so that another scientist could do what I do, could repeat the experiment that I ran. And also every inferential link, like every link that I make between ideas, has to be laid out super clearly for people. That's the goal anyways in scientific writing, is to be completely transparent and to be complete. The goal in science writing is to know what to leave out for the public when you're writing for the public. So, you know, as I would say, you know, my husband is a civilian. You know, he's not a scientist. That's, in my house, that's what we call civilians. He's not an academic scientist. And so, you know, he's constantly asking me, like when I'm writing, you know, is that for the 1%, by which he means like the other scientists I write for? So when you're, you know, is this detail, does this detail have to be there? Does like the average person really need to know that detail? Or are you putting that detail in for the 1%, meaning the other academic scientists? The point is that you have to be accurate, but you have to know what to leave out when you're writing for the public and still have the story be as truthful as possible. And that's a really hard thing to do.
Well, Lisa, this has been terrific. I hope you come back and see us again. I still have a whole bunch of questions for you.
I would love to. That would be wonderful. This was fun.
My guest today is neuroscientist and psychologist Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. Her book is 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. So many times, multiple medical conditions are actually associated with, if not driven by, a single recognizable symptom. In this case, inflammation. From rheumatoid arthritis to Crohn's disease and many more, 180 Life Sciences is a new company focusing on diseases which are driven by inflammation. And the compound most advanced in their pipeline is Dupuytren's contracture. Ever heard of it? Well, one out of 25 people in North America and Europe have. That's how many have it. Dr. Jim Woody is the CEO of 180 Life Sciences.
Yes, ironically, my wife has this and had to go through the entire process and eventually have surgery to correct it. But it's very common in the U.S. and in Europe, especially in the Scandinavian countries. And interestingly enough, one of my board members of 180LS also told me that he has it because his grandfather had it. So there's a genetic component to this Dupuytren's. And what happens is a nodule forms in your palm, and it gradually pulls your fingers together until they're kind of immobile and you're a little disabled.
Now, what is causing this? And when does it happen? Can it happen at any time in a lifespan?
It's generally in older people, 40 to, say, 60. And why it starts, no one really knows. There seems to be, as I mentioned, because of the Scandinavian countries, some sort of genetic disposition to do this. And it just starts up as a nodule, and then the nodule gradually forms what they call fibrosis in your hands, and it starts to pull the fingers together.
Does it happen in other parts of the body, or is it primarily in the hand?
This is mostly in the hand, one hand or the other. And there's another condition called frozen shoulder, where about 50% of those people have Dupuytren's. And we think it's the same process going on in the shoulder, which is extremely painful and causes your shoulder to be immobilized. It's another disease area that we're working on.
What's the normal treatment for this?
Typically, they have a number of treatments. They try some steroids. They generally don't work very well. There's a collagenase that dissolves some of the collagen, but it has a lot of side effects. And sometimes damages the wrong tissue. And eventually you have surgery to relieve all the contractures. And that's where my wife ended up.
Now you work on something called TNF, tumor necrosis factor. Tumors we don't like. Necrosis means death. Factors, who cares? It's like, what is tumor necrosis factor? Because this is linked in to the work that you do.
That's absolutely correct. So a long time ago, a Dr. Cerami in New York was looking at proteins that are in the blood. You have thousands of proteins circulating around in your blood. Some of them send messages to different cells on what to do. Some of them tell them to stop. Some of them are good actors. Some are bad actors. Well, he found this one called that he was testing in mice with tumors, and it made their tumors go away. And so he named this tumor necrosis factor. It never worked in people, but it worked well in mice, I guess. And so what we found, Dr. Feldman and I, that this tumor necrosis factor is what drives the inflammation in rheumatoid arthritis and in Crohn's disease and in psoriasis. And we were the very first to ever treat anybody with a blocking agent called anti-TNF. It's an antibody now known as Remicade. We were the very first to do that. And there's no patients in wheelchairs with RA because of that drug and its follow-on.
Well, let's go back there. Initially, when you're trying a new drug on people who are seriously ill, it's a very challenging thing. What exactly did you do?
Yes. Well, Dr. Feldman and I had been working together, and he was able to get human tissue from joints of people with arthritis that had to have the joints repaired. And he was able to look at all of these mediators, TNF, some called IL-1, some called IL-6. And he found out if you block TNF, it shut all the rest of them off. And that was the idea that said, you know, this is going to be helpful in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Yeah, the woman who did the actual trials was called Fionnuala Brennan. It was a brilliant study. And that was the foundation. And we lined up 10 patients, all in wheelchairs. And we administered the drug for the first time. This was done in England. And in 20 minutes, they said their fatigue is gone and their pain is away. And several of them got out of their wheelchairs and actually did a dance down a stairway. Unbelievable.
Now, come on.
I'm sorry. We have the videos. I mean, it was like the movie, you know, where the people all wake up and they loved it. Then we treated more patients and showed that it worked very well. And another friend of mine in the Netherlands, Dr. Van Deventer, felt that from his studies with human tissue that TNF was causing Crohn's disease. That's, inflammatory bowel disease. And we treated one patient and she got well and went back to riding her horse. So and the rest of that is history.
So this is this anti-TNF, inhibitors. You want to dampen down the TNF. It actually dampens down a bunch of things. And that's what's involved in many of these conditions that you're looking at now.
That's exactly right. The antibody that we give binds up the TNF so it can't work. It's a little like the idea of the COVID vaccines right now. The antibodies that the president got from Regeneron bound up the virus so it couldn't work. Well, in our case, we're binding up this TNF so it can't work anymore.
So now we have a brand new company, 180 Life Sciences. And you and Dr. Feldman are still together.
That's right. And we've worked together for a long time and we're good colleagues. And so this is exciting because we both know how to develop these drugs. And we've also added on Dr. Steinman, who was another colleague. He developed a drug called Tysabri for patients with multiple sclerosis. Similar kind of idea where they're able to block up the inflammation. So the three of us are working together, and also Dr. Rothbard, who's a chemist, joined us.
Now, Dr. Rothbard, he's at Stanford.
That's right. And Dr. Steinman's at Stanford. Well, he's a pediatric neurologist there.
Now, as I understand it, you also have a research group in Israel. What are they doing?
So this is a group that we, Dr. Feldman has been working on, and they're developing novel compounds for the cannabis area. And the compounds they're developing are called cannabidiol. And these will be compounds that don't have any hallucinations. They don't have any addiction potential. And they're easily absorbable. And we already know that they work in inflammation and pain. So it adds into the strength of our other programs when we get these done. But they'll be very different from what you think is either cannabis or anything else, because they'll be very focused on just pain and inflammation.
Now, I usually don't go down through the list, but I just want to get everybody to understand this is a brand new company and you're working on all kinds of things. You're working on post-operative dementia?
Yes, that's right. And what we find is that in older people that have to have, hip surgery after they fall down and break their hip, or they are going through a coronary artery bypass graft, that following the surgery, they have some dementia. They can't remember where they are. And this persists for a few days in many, and in some, maybe a third or a quarter, it goes on for months and months. And some of them end up in nursing homes, which is not a good outcome, and have to be cared for. And we think that the trauma of the surgery releases the TNF, and that the TNF causes the dementia. And we've got some evidence that that's the case in animals, and we also can measure this in the patients undergoing surgery. So one of our trials will be to treat these patients with our anti-TNF and see if we can reduce or eliminate the dementia.
And I have another note here, smoking cessation.
Yes, unbeknownst to me, but with Dr. Steinman, it turns out that patients with ulcerative colitis often smoke a lot. And the nicotine in the smoke is an anti-inflammatory, mild, but it also, the smoke causes the damage. And so when they try to stop smoking, their ulcerative colitis gets worse. So what he's developing is a special new molecule that just binds to this nicotine receptor so that you don't have the addiction problem with the smoking, but you also get the benefit of the nicotine anti-inflammatory. That's the focus of the program, and they're in the process of selecting the best of these molecules to actually try out.
All of you have a lot of experience in going through clinical trials and coming out with a drug that's commercially viable and continues to work over time. And you've already got the Dupuytren's is already in fully enrolled in this phase 2B/3 clinical trial. It's already down the line here. Tell us about that. What are you doing? What are you testing?
Yes, this is a trial that's being run in England. It's actually funded by the Wellcome Trust and the National Health Service. We enrolled 180 patients with early Dupuytren's before it caused a deformity, and we're injecting these nodules I mentioned earlier with anti-TNF, and they get four doses. All of them have been treated. We're in the follow-up period for 6 months and 9 months now. And because of the COVID, it's been a little delayed because of getting around to visit the patients and measure things. So we're measuring whether the nodules get soft and go away or whether the fingers start to contract at all. Half of them are treated with the drug and half of them are treated with a placebo. In this case, it's just saline. So we'll know whether the drug works when this trial is completed and the data is out probably about the middle of next year.
Now, are these injections?
Yeah, they're very teeny injections into the nodule in the hand. We've actually done the chemical tests in these nodules. What's driving the fibrosis? We know what it is. It's a substance called SMA. And we know if we inject with anti-TNF, it blocks that from progressing the fibrosis.
Now, are there any conditions that you're looking, you know, in the future to look at besides the ones we've mentioned?
Well, there's a liver condition called NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, and the liver forms a lot of fibrosis there. And we think that we may be able to address this with some of our anti-TNFs or other agents that we have. So that's a project that's at the laboratory bench that we're working on.
I have to say that this idea, and this happens, doesn't happen often, but it does happen in science, that once you figure out something that's about the system, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, we could try it here, here, and here. That's exactly what's happening here, right?
It's exactly right. And so with our research, we're trying to discover those areas where we think the anti-TNFs will work. And we have another generation coming along after this that are quite different from the antibodies that will be even better because the antibodies block a number of things, some good, some bad, because the anti-TNF antibodies, and there's five or six of them approved in the U.S. now, they leave you susceptible to some infectious diseases, and one has to be very careful. So we have new compounds in the future that we think will avoid all that but still give you the anti-inflammatory properties you want.
I love the idea of you guys are in all these different places and you're like, hey, you know, we could put the show on right here. We'll just all stay on our places. We're going to get together. We're going to have this 180 Life Sciences. Why did you name it 180 Life Sciences?
Well, typically the anti-TNFs are kind of going down one track. Almost all of them exactly follow what we did from CentiCor a long time ago. Rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's and psoriasis, a few other things, but they're not very adventurous. And so we're turning this around 180, and we're saying we're going in a whole different, unique directions.
Is there an advantage being able to be in multiple countries right from the start? You said, gee, this is going on in the UK, and this is going on in the US. What are there advantages here?
Well, the advantage is you go where the experts are. In Israel, these are the people who invented the CBD and discovered those molecules. They know more about it than anybody else in the world.
CBD?
That's cannabis.
Ah.
That's the active ingredient in cannabis. So they know about this. They've been doing this for like 20 years. So what we're doing is focusing it on a very specific anti-inflammatory agent. Same in England, the people doing the trials on the Dupuytren's and the frozen shoulder, they're the experts. So you go where the experts are.
And the experts are 180 Life Sciences. Is that the right answer?
That's exactly right.
Good. That's good. I have to say, I've heard a lot of stories on all these years, but this is the first time that I've heard all these senior people. You were once president of Roche Bioscience, among other many other things that you've done. I mean, we're talking senior people all over the world. You got together, you started this company, and you're all hitting the ground running. This isn't like a slow, or we got one thing going here. What brought all this together?
Well, I think like many of us, we are interested in inventing new things that help patients. And we're interested in novel new concepts and ideas and managing some of the science. And for us, this is exciting. This is what we love to do, as you love what you're doing. And it's all worthwhile. And especially if you have a team like this, this is a dream team of people who really know what they're doing and have done it before.
Jim, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and see us again. Keep us updated, won't you?
Well, when the trial data comes out, we'll be happy to discuss it with you and see how well it worked.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Jim Woody is the CEO of 180 Life Sciences. More information is available at 180lifesciences.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.